Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Naomi Starkman, Communications and Policy Director for Slow Food Nation, the largest celebration of food in America taking place in San Francisco over Labor Day weekend. This program is part of our How We Eat series, an in-depth look at our eating habits, health, and the mechanisms surrounding how we get our food. Our panelists tonight are Don Schaefer, President and CEO of RSF Social Finance, a nonprofit financial services organization at the center of a growing movement to create a network of place-based local economies that value human beings and the environment. Inspired by the work of Rudolf Steiner, RSF has made over $145 million in loans and over $65 million in grants since 1984 to organizations in the areas of food and agriculture, education in the arts, and ecological stewardship. This year, RSF is launching a new mezzanine fund for social enterprises seeking growth capital and a program-related investing fund for foundations seeking to make charitable loans. In the past year, Don has served as interim executive director of Investors Circle. RSF is a sponsor of Slow Food Nation. Michael Dimmick, president of Roots of Change, a non-governmental organization. ROC's purpose is to create a sustainable food system in California by the year 2030. ROC involves 11 foundations, over 900 leaders from NGOs and businesses, state and local government. ROC makes available funds and other resources for leaders who are collaboratively implementing a multi-sector strategy known as California's Campaign for a New Mainstream in Food, Farms, and Fisheries. ROC is a sponsor and partner of Slow Food Nation. They are working to curate Changemakers Day at Slow Food Nation, which will convene hundreds of leaders focused on sustainable food systems. Roots of Change is also developing a launch for a petition calling for a new vision for a 21st century food, farm, and agricultural policy. Paul Frankel, co-founder and managing director of Ecosa Capital Management, where he advises companies in the areas of clean tech and sustainable businesses on fundraising and management strategy. Ecosa works with sustainable, emerging, and growth stage firms whose business practices, products, and services offer superior economic profits and also provide social or ecological benefits. Paul is an industry fellow at the Center for Entrepreneurship and Technology at Berkeley. Tonight, we are in conversation about how the centralization of food production is affecting what we eat. Centralization of capital has an impact on every level of our food system, from the limited number of the crops we rely on to the limited number of corporations that process our food. Critics say that centralization hinders the creation of small alternative food businesses and for neighborhood or city-based solutions to be developed by communities. Tonight's panel will explore how the American food system is shaped by centralization in production, consumption, and economic cycles. I'd like to open today's conversation by asking each of the panelists to answer this question. What does centralization of food mean to you? Is centralization such a bad thing? How did we get here? And what are the options for going forward? What are some future food models? And I'd like to start this conversation by asking Michael Dimmick to answer for us.
Thank you, Naomi. It's an important question. I think before I get into the answer in depth, I'd like to just back up a little and talk about the system that we have now, why it exists. The system we have is a perfect response to the economic rules of the game. Right now, the food system exists and looks like it does because the ultimate value underlying the system is profit. It's profit. And so we have created financial tools, regulatory environment, a way of thinking in the entrepreneurs and farmers that run businesses that has, in fact, led to fewer and fewer producers, retailers, and all the folks in between. because in order to remain profitable in the current environment, you have to get bigger. And this goes way back. Most notably, any of you who have read the work by Michael Pollan, either in Omnivore's Dilemma or in Defense of Food, know that in the 1960s, Earl Butz, who was the Secretary of Agriculture, told farmers to get big or get out and to plant fence post to fence post. And that was really the signal to the system. That was the beginning of the signal of the system to do what they've done, and they've done it well. The problem is, when you have one underlying value, profit, many other things are lost. Outcomes are lost. So what we see is that health has been forgotten. So this is getting into the answer to the question. What does concentration mean to me? It means that we actually are not getting the food system that we actually need to optimize the health, productivity of the nation. And that is the issue before us. And I think I'll leave it there and pass it off to my colleagues.
Thanks, Michael. And Naomi, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for this panel. I'm looking forward to the discussion. First, Michael, I agree with you. I think that the system has been optimized for profit. And from that system optimization, we see that technologists as well as farmers as well as markets have been focused on a singular outcome, which is not optimization, but maximization of returns. And those returns are based typically on returns per acre or per bushel. We need to look at some other returns and have a discussion about what are some of the other values that we hold dear to us in society, and we can then optimize our policy to optimize those outcomes as well. So if our values reflect local community, heritage, culture, as well as taste and health of the food that we eat, then we can optimize for those. I happen to also believe that centralization, as the question was posed, is a necessary component, regardless of whether we pursue a more industrialized model or more localized model. Centralization is an important function because it helps us achieve scale and it helps achieve profitability. Those outcomes in and of themselves are not bad, but in the system that we operate in and under the rules of the game, they're necessary. And at other levels, regardless of the rules of the game, we have certain outcomes that we need to achieve regardless, because we have costs and inputs that are all important to the health of a viable business, and there's just really no way around that if we want to be able to maintain a certain quality of life and certain lifestyle. So I'd say in a brief answer to the question, centralization is neither good nor bad, but it's a tool, and the question is how do we work with that tool in order to achieve the outcomes we want to achieve.
Thanks, Paul, and Michael, and Naomi. I think I just cut to the chase on what I think would head us towards a solution is that we all need to invest our money differently. That's if you look at the root causes, we can vilify Wall Street investment bankers for their greed or the SEC for basically being an appendage of Wall Street or other parts of the regulatory system, other parts of the financial system. We can externalize the problem, but the reality is that all of us as investors, I'm assuming that most people here in the room have some kind of retirement savings, which is most likely invested in mutual funds or what have you. There are probably a decent amount of people in the room that own Monsanto stock that may not even know that they do as part of their investments in their retirement savings. So that's the first place I'd start is that we need to invest our money differently, not just in publicly traded equities and debt. But that's what RSF Social Finance is about, and working with Paul, Michael, many, many others here in the Bay Area and nationwide to try and create more alternatives for people to invest their money locally in sustainable companies and organizations that are creating healthy, diversified food systems based on sustainable agriculture. So right now there aren't as many options as there need to be. There need to be more smart people and more capital focusing on these issues. And I'll just give you a few examples of organizations that we're considering making loans to or helping to facilitate funding for right now, to give you an idea of what would be great to have as a balance. It's not to say everyone should take their life savings and invest in these companies tomorrow, because there are risk and liquidity issues involved. And but I'm just going to mention some examples to give you a flavor of if there were literally hundreds or thousands of organizations like this that could get access to capital, we would have a much different food system. So isn't going to answer all the complexities that have to do with land use and water and equity and all kinds of things, but I'll just give you some examples. So one is Brahma Mati runs an organization called People's Grocery in West Oakland. Anyone who's familiar with People's Grocery out there? A fair amount of people. So they West Oakland currently, I think, has 37 liquor stores and not a single grocery store that serves fresh food. So they're looking to create a retail grocery that that serves fresh food, nutrient-dense food, locally and organically and biodynamically produced food. And it's not a simple path for how to get access to the kind of capital that's needed to create this kind of organization. Another one is Sally Calhoun of Piscinas Ranch in San Benito County, which is about 90 miles south of here, just inland from Monterey. Her vision is to create a network of small-scale, humane, ecologically sound slaughterhouses for beef and other meat products. Right now, that industry, if you were to pick one, might be one of the most horrific in the food system. And so the idea is that, you know, in San Benito County, in Petaluma, in Eureka, there'd be a network of, as I say, small-scale, humane slaughterhouses that would serve the regional market here. I'll cut myself off with one more. Rich Collins of Bridgeway Farms in Yolo County, he's looking to create essentially a farm stand, but right off of Route 80, because there are 48 million cars that go by there every year. And this would be a farm stand committed completely to not only providing local and organically produced food, but also education and all kinds of other approaches to building awareness for why these kinds of things are important. So those are just a smattering of these are entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, that have difficulty getting access to capital, and we all are, you know, in funneling all of our money into S&P 500 index funds on Wall Street, are not allowing these people to get out there and do what they need to do.
And just to follow up on that question, the first question being, you know, how did we get here? Paul, you and I were talking earlier a little bit about the number of farms in America today, and I was hoping you'd share some of those figures with the audience tonight.
Sure. Was doing a little bit of prep for this panel, looking at some of the data out there, and found a really nice series written by the Washington Post from, I think it was back in late 2006, looking at the upcoming farm bill and issues surrounding that. 24% of all U.S. farms are considered small and medium-sized farms. Very large or large farms in the U.S. total about 7% of all farms. Just to put those in real numbers, small, medium farms, about 504,000 of those out there, and very large farms, we're talking about 148,000 farms. And corporate farms, which is apparently another category, are about 36,000, or 1.7% of all farms. So we see actually a tremendous number of small farms out there. But, Michael, I believe you had the statistic in terms of how much of our food production is actually produced by those farms, and the numbers are actually flipped completely around.
Right. It's interesting to know. Well, I know specifically in California, but I think we can get the federal number there. But in California, 10% of the farms are producing 60% of all the food. So what we have is a lot of small farms that produce very little food, and then we have a few farms that are producing a huge amount of food. And, for instance, a big chain like, even in the sustainable world, Whole Foods, they have to buy from larger farms in order to supply their system. So even in the organic world, you know, there's even though there are a lot of organic farms, there are a few of the farms that are producing a tremendous amount of the food, Del Cabo and others.
And I think it's important to note that it's not just the farm system that we need to include in this topic of discussion, but also the distribution and retail part of the chain as well, because those need to scale in order to meet the needs of the farmers. But again, to the point of centralization, that's where the centralization actually occurs, is in the distribution chain and at the retailers. Mm-hmm. We've seen a proliferation of family farms. I know, Michael, you can talk about that quite well. They're on the rise, and there are more of them now as kind of a renaissance period in those that we have seen probably in the last, say, 10 to 15 years. That's providing an alternative means of distribution for these farms.
Farmers markets.
Yes. So that's those types of business models and those types of distribution channels, as well as going direct to consumers, which we see the advent of, have seen the advent of over the last, say, 5 to 10 years with the proliferation of the internet. That's another way where we can accommodate larger numbers of growers and also meet the needs of consumers in the local economies.
I think it's important to note that what the current system does well is it creates a price point that makes food more affordable for people, particularly in a system like we're in now where energy is underpinning and changing the prices of food and availability of food. The system does that well. It produces food that's inexpensive relative to other things in the economy that we need to purchase. The problem is that it does that in a policy framework which allows the producers of food to externalize costs. What I mean by that is a farmer is not having to build in the cost of pollution to water or other areas into the cost of food. And you and I, when we go to the grocery store and pay for that food, we don't pay for it. Where we pay for it is when we're taxed and the EPA and all the agencies that go clean that up. So that's where the regulatory environment becomes really important. If we're going to change the system and break out of this concentration, what we're going to do is create incentives for farmers on farms to manage these problems and for processing companies to manage these problems at the place of production. But that, again, goes back to this idea of what are the underlying values. Do we care about health? Do we care about pollution prevention? Or do we only care about profit?
Well, the good news, I think we'd agree or have already stated in some ways, is that there's a lot of momentum right now and a lot of consciousness being raised about the importance of local and regional economies, local and regional food systems. And sometimes change only happens when there's a crisis. So there have been a handful of significant food safety issues recently. And then the price of oil is making some of the economic case for moving avocados and apples and walnuts and all kinds of other foodstuffs all over the planet. So far, you know, a bit less viable. So it'd be interesting to see how things develop. But right now, what we're trying to do is capitalize on the growing awareness about the importance of local food systems based on sustainable agriculture, and not have it be just kind of a fad that pops up when oil's at $4, you know, and gas at $4 a gallon, but that can sustain itself and really, really go deep. So we're encouraged that there is some shift, not just amongst those in the Bay Area that are foodies, and there are a lot of us that I think are very much into our food here in the Bay Area, but even in the mainstream, it seems like there's percolation around these things.
And to that point, Paul, we were talking earlier also about some of the examples in the Bay Area that are good national models for local businesses that are meeting that rising demand for organic and sustainable food. And I thought maybe you could share some of those examples, and if any of the other panelists want to jump in and also talk about some of the good regional and national business models.
Sure. I think that we have seen companies innovate their business models in order to meet the demands of their customers and of the marketplace, where of course, you start with a particular business model in mind and a plan to achieve, but that plan changes based on the demands of the market and based on the constraints of the market. Don, you can speak about this as well with some of the business plans that you're looking at funding at RSF. For example, I'll talk a little bit about Cowgirl Creamery. They started out producing some of it. Many folks here in the room and nationally know that brand. They're a local brand that was started in Petaluma by a couple of local folks with experience in the restaurant industry and wanted to craft artisan cheeses. They started to produce their own brands, but only produced a very small number of items, maybe two or three choices of their specialty artisan cheese to start with. Well, that income from selling those items was not enough to sustain a business and grow a business the way they wanted to do so, and so they ended up changing their model to be not just a producer but also a distributor of other cheeses, both nationally here in the U.S., or domestic cheese, excuse me, as well as artisan cheese from Europe and other places. So they were able to change their model. We are looking at companies here locally that also started out as family farms and have grown with national retail chains like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, and they've been able to do that by doing things like private labeling, where they were maybe selling on a more localized level earlier, and as they've grown, they've been able to recruit growers in other localities around the nation. We see this in the beef and pork production as well. Nyman Ranch is a good example of this, where they push their standards out to producers and suppliers up the supply chain, and while they're not able to own all the means of production, they're able to set standards and, in essence, control the means of production and spread their risk by using multiple suppliers. And in so doing, they're also able to invigorate local economies in places that have seen production maybe move to more highly concentrated places, such as the Midwest for beef or here in California for dairy.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing the centralization of our food system. Joining me in this discussion are Don Schaefer, President and CEO of RSF Social Finance, Michael Dimmick, President of Roots of Change, and Paul Frankel, Managing Director of Ecosa Capital. And to the point of local and regional companies who are sort of setting the standard for business models, I was hoping that perhaps we had some national business models we could discuss as well.
Well, Natural Country Beef is probably a very good example. Natural Country Beef began as a group of ranching families in southeast Oregon. It was originally called Oregon Country Beef. They established a program for raising cattle in an environmentally sound way, mimicking nature. I won't go into that, but it's a really beautiful system for raising animals. They rapidly built a market. They went from 7 ranches. Pretty soon they were at 14. Then they were in the 20s. And they did a distribution deal with Whole Foods and many other kind of specially high-end retailers. And their steaks were in the $25 a pound for filet mignon, really fine beef. Well, it was so successful that other parts of the country started to say, we would like to be part of that system. So like Nyman Ranch, which began here in pork and beef production and went national, they did the same thing. They established a set of standards and are now all over the nation. They changed the name from Oregon Country Beef to Natural Country Beef. And now you can find Natural Country Beef all over the United States, particularly kind of in the South Midwest area. And then I guess another would be Crop or the dairy company.
Organic Valley.
Organic Valley, thank you very much. Organic Valley Dairy, which began as a co-op in Wisconsin, a group of farmers, dairymen, who were being killed by the concentration that was going on. They were going out of business. And they realized that they had to do it a different way if they were going to survive. And so they took on organic certification. And then they built slowly began to build, again, a group of relationships, a co-op that's has grown nationally now. We have Organic Valley producers in the state of California, all over the nation. They also, beyond dairy, milk, and kind of primary dairy, they're also doing beef and pork and other items now. Same idea. So it's kind of reinvigoration of rural zones that were being, and this really goes back to the question of what concentration mean. What concentration has really meant in many areas, which is ironic, that it's actually created a lot of poverty in rural regions where there used to be diverse, vibrant economies, where there were many family farms and small towns with lots of different businesses. The concentration, what that's done is allowed really wealth to be extracted from rural regions, and so you have huge unemployment. Here in California, Fresno County, which is the largest producing agricultural county in the state of California, is also among the poorest. Why is that? It's because there are very few jobs, really. They've been lost because efficiency and concentration means less people are employed. And what that means is the job base drops, and then pretty soon you have this incredible thing, the most food production in Fresno and also the highest level of food insecurity as measured by the federal government in the same county. So that's really interesting to see.
And to that point, a member of the audience sent a question, and I think it's a good one as a follow-up to your point, which is if, in fact, we are able to follow with these means of production, and might that mean that food costs will increase, and how does a struggling family, how will a struggling family be able to meet those costs?
Well, I can talk about that in the context of another example that I was going to point out from the previous question. There's a grocery called New Seasons Market in Portland, Oregon, that's they now have 8 or 9 outlets, and they purposefully have made the choice not to grow beyond the greater Portland area because they would like to serve their region. They don't want the extra they don't want to make more money than they're making now. They don't want the extra hassle of the management, and they just want to grow deeper in their community. And to what's underlying your question, Naomi, there are some questions around elitism, around the local regional food movement. Is it only accessible for the affluent? And what New Seasons did recently, they opened at their 8th or 9th outlet in a low-income area of Portland, and there are many people who said that's not going to fly. It's now their second highest grossing store out of their 9, and they've found a way to get the pricing such that a wide range of people can take advantage of it, and that would be a whole nother conversation talking about exactly how that works. But the point is, there are now starting to be examples where locally, regionally focused entities are getting the price point down to where people can afford it.
And I think it's interesting to point out that one way they've been able to achieve that is by not being purist in their approach to the market. And specifically how they've done that is they've carried a wide variety of selection in their stores that isn't only organic or isn't only natural, but it's a blend of multiple brands and multiple value propositions to the customer who shops at their store. So local, as well as national brands, you can find soda on the shelf next to your next to water, next to your artisan beverages, and everything else. So they've done it by achieving a nice mixture of product on the shelf, and that appeals to a wide variety of clientele.
I think there's another piece of this puzzle because and it involves the fact that, going back to the idea of how do we measure success. Currently, the current economic climate system measure success as cheap food, profitable companies only, right? It's narrowed to that. Well, if we begin to factor in the idea of human health, that is community health in the nation, the health of the population in general, if we start to calculate that or include that in the formula of what we consider success, it might become a different set of programs, policies that we would undertake. What I mean by that, if people aren't eating well, as many currently are not, particularly in low-income neighborhoods, they are becoming unhealthy at a very early age. We know this diabetes and obesity is huge in those communities, low-income communities. So we have to, as a culture, take care of that problem, and we do it through emergency rooms and hospitals, and all the health care costs on the far end, toward the other half, the second half of human life. So if we were to say it actually makes more sense, and there are people in the state of California, including the Secretary of Agriculture here, A.G. Kalamura, who are thinking about this, maybe what we should be doing is enhancing our food stamp programs. Maybe we should be subsidizing more good food into the inner cities, into low-income communities, because in the end it's going to cost the culture less financially, and it's going to increase the vitality, the productivity, and the satisfaction of life for everyone in the system. I think that's the way we have to start thinking about this.
And one of the audience sent a good question, too, which is if one of you could speak to the increase in calories being sold to us as it relates to food centralization and that sense of what we are subsidizing, in fact, currently, what models do we have, what government policies are supporting the types of food coming from above from the centralized model as we see it now.
We have to go again, Michael.
I was going to say the primary subsidies that go on in the system right now are for 5-6 crops. We all know about the year, but in the news, the whole debate when the Farm Bill was going on. It's about the fact that there are what they call program crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, several others, tobacco. Well, tobacco is pretty much over, but cotton. There are other program crops, and they are actually subsidized. Now, why is that done? It's done because it does produce cheap calories, which goes into the processed food. So, and this really gets, in one way, to the heart of the issue. If you study history of governments, governments get into trouble with the populace when people can't eat. Starvation, high food costs. Look at what's happened in the news in the last 6 months, 7 months, as energy costs and food costs have gone up. You've heard politicians talking about this issue really quickly. Why? Because it turns governments over. It turns governments over. So we've had policies in order to get cheap calories so that people feel like they're eating. So the issue is we've gone too far. So we have program crops. All we really subsidize in this country are cheap calorie production, which really ends up being corn, soybeans, things that go into manufactured food that end up in the center aisles of every grocery store. So what we're talking about, I think, here is changing the subsidy system so that the right things are subsidized, things that produce health, not cheap calories.
Well, as a good capitalist, I'm not talking about subsidizing any businesses per se.
Good.
But certainly some markets and some mechanisms require help from the outside if they don't fit the current model of profits and returns. And so another way, another metric of how we measure success is by scale. Typically, we hear the bigger is better. Some in this room may know the axiom, small is beautiful, which is one that I like myself. But we see that scale can be achieved in a number of different ways through different business models. So scale can be massive and behemoth, large industrial size manufacturing operations and processing operations, or we can see that scale can also be achieved by replication. I think New Seasons is a great model of a company that has made a conscious decision that is highly profitable and is very comfortable with the scale that they've achieved to date. The way that they will continue to succeed is by seeding similar business models in communities like the state of Oregon and specifically around the city of Portland, in other communities across the country. So rather than necessarily subsidizing, although in some cases that may be necessary, if we can proliferate the business models that lead to healthier systems overall, I think we'll be better off for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on this question, I'm thinking that since World War II, we've essentially applied an industrialized, purely industrialized approach to food, when for all of us in our DNA memory and our lived experience through our ancestors, I come from small family farmers, Quakers in the Philadelphia area, that experience is one where food and community go together. This is just something that we've all we can all identify with, and I feel like we're now reaching a point where the abstraction from our food that has been encouraged in the industrial system since World War II is now, it's starting to crack. You know, people are really experiencing a visceral thirst for the need to connect with their food and the relationship between food and community. And that, I feel, is very, very encouraging and is now causing people to make different choices with their dollars. So let's hope that continues to happen.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing the centralization of our food. Joining me in this discussion are Don Schaefer, President and CEO of RSF Social Finance, Michael Dimmick, President of Roots of Change, and Paul Frankel, Managing Director of Ecosa Capital. So let's talk a little bit about the large companies that are trying to join the rising trend of organic. Let's talk about Walmart, for example. Walmart is one of the largest suppliers now of organic food, and they've just made a huge effort to sell and buy from local farmers. How will that impact current trends in centralization?
I think it's a great development myself. Because this actually gets back to energy and this issue of subsidies. If you look at the two big subsidy systems in our government, they're around energy and food. And there are reasons for that, because those are the two primary systems that underpin a civilization. If you're going to have a functional civilization, you got to have energy, and you got to have food. So, and water is the other big one. So that created the system we have. The issue that's going on right now worldwide is that energy is becoming more expensive. So if you look at what happened with Walmart and also Cisco, which is the largest food distributor in the United States, wholesale, if you look at those two companies, they first began to respond to these issues around the idea of energy, cost of energy for producing, for distributing food to their retail stores or to their clientele, restaurants and hotels. So they had to respond to the rising energy costs, and one of the first thing that they both arrived at was the need to decentralize their sourcing, because right now, huge amounts of food come from very few places. We've talked about that. There are very few farms producing the largest amounts of food. So they have to send trucks long ways to get food. So what they're talking about now, what they're meeting about, what they're sitting down with farmers and organizations to talk about are how can they actually source within regions. Now that's going to be a beautiful outcome for these two gentlemen who are looking for investment opportunities, because there are going to be rural communities all around the country that are going to look to get capital to expand their production to supply Walmart and Cisco with the kinds of foods that they're looking to deliver. So it's, from my perspective, very exciting.
Ditto. I think it's a good thing. There's been a lot, again, the vilification issue. There's been a lot of vilification of Walmart over the past 5 years, and my great hope is that there will be many, many, many more New Seasons type markets than there are Walmarts and Whole Foods over the years, and I think there will be as this market continues to mature. So I think that the role that they can play is important, and Michael articulated it well.
I think they serve a couple of other really important purposes in driving this market forward. Number one, they bring awareness and education to the customer. The consumer that shops at Walmart heretofore has not really believed that they've had access to this type of food. So it's important for them to know that and see it there. Not only is Walmart one of the largest or the largest seller of organic food, but they're also pushing through standards for sustainable fisheries as well. And so that's the second point that's important here, which is that they are driving standards throughout their supply chain, which many suppliers would either not listen to or not pay attention to if any smaller customer had come to them and tried to make those requirements stick. Or they are giving life to new suppliers or young suppliers who may need to scale the meat production for the demand of a customer like Walmart, and otherwise they may not be around, or they may exist on a much smaller scale. Again, we've talked a little bit about ways to achieve that. And third, they are going to reduce the price because of the demand, and they're going to make this accessible to a larger portion of the consumer population. So I agree. I think it's good in general. And I'm sure that over time they'll be able to refine the model and be able to be more stringent or healthier about the requirements that they're putting on their suppliers, and I think that over time it can be a virtuous cycle where we see an improvement overall.
So not only is Walmart one of the largest purchasers of organic and perhaps local food now in the United States, but it also is a big investor in food coming from all over the world. And I was hoping that perhaps each of you could talk a little bit about how the global world production of food and the impending world food crisis will in fact impact centralization in this country.
Well, I can start with one example that I read about several months ago. This is the equivalent of Organic Valley in New Zealand. This is the largest co-op of dairy farmers in New Zealand, and they have been put under pressure to scale up faster based on the demand for dairy products worldwide and to increase their exports exponentially and essentially capitalize on a strength that they have in that country. The substantial majority of the leadership of the co-op, as representative of the full body of the co-op, has made the decision not to expand nearly as fast as they could, because they feel like soil health and soil fertility and ecological stewardship of the land, long-term interests of the land and the livelihood of the people there, is taking precedent over the short-term money that they could make. And so this will be interesting to see how this plays out in other places. The vote required a supermajority, 67% or greater of the co-op members, to disapprove of this shift to opening up their market further, and 75% of them said no. We want to incrementally grow, but we don't want to shoot the moon. So I think that's an interesting development on the international
level. I think another interesting development is I actually heard it on the radio the other day. It was a Kenyan. On an editorial radio, kind of radio editorial, was talking about the need for African countries to think less about producing cash crops that they could send to Europe and other parts of the world, and think more about feeding themselves because of the world, the impending food crisis due to energy primarily underneath it all. I think that's a really important development because part of the cycle of starvation that's been going on in Africa is the fact that they've been focused, because of the economic system, the rules of the game we've created, been focused on exporting in order to raise cash, to have cash crops for their economies, their balance of payments. And that has created this reliance on external sources of food at times of drought and other weather crises or crop failures. So That is a very unhealthy cycle. I think it creates lots of other perturbations in their systems. And so I think it's very encouraging that the discussion around, and I think this will be coming up during Slow Food, that weekend of lectures, Slow Food Nation, there'll be a lot of discussion about kind of local food sovereignty, the idea that regions of the world must become responsible and must become more in control of their own food supplies. Which has huge implications for a state like California, which is an export-oriented state, and we can get into that another time. But.
Yeah, and I mean, this goes also back to the public policy part of the discussion. And given the subsidies that we see for corn and soybeans and rice around the world, we're paying people to not produce. Maybe we don't need as many corn farmers. Maybe we need to talk about what are some of the alternatives to production of corn and what are the uses of those alternatives? And so, again, that comes back to developing new market opportunities. It also goes back to this idea of some sort of government assistance or potentially subsidization by helping producers transition to new crops. I've been involved with a couple of projects recently in the citrus industry, which are directly confronting this issue of how do we switch from one mode of production to another, from one crop to another. It's an expensive proposition that not all farmers who we all know are asset rich and cash poor have the means to be able to do. So if there is going to be a discussion about public policy and subsidies and cash crops and alternatives to those, then we need to be prepared to have a discussion also about how we're going to assist producers to transition as well.
So we've discussed some of the private sector models for making a change in our food system and touched a little bit on some of the public policy discussions. But what can our cities do? What can our communities do to change this paradigm?
Well, I think one very exciting thing happening here in San Francisco is that the mayor has invited I think this is the first time this has happened, perhaps in the United States, but certainly here in California. The mayor of San Francisco has invited 15 leaders from the rural region surrounding the city and 15 leaders from the city of San Francisco, all involved in food, so farmers, Secretary of Agriculture for the state, to sit down beginning in October in four meetings to discuss the idea of San Francisco's food shed and how can the city of San Francisco become an active participant in the creation of a food shed that partners with the rural region for about 200 miles around the city. I think this is a very exciting development because it could create a model that could be used around the state of California and other parts of the country, because I think there is a reality to the concept of food sheds. Just like we have watersheds, areas that the water is collected to feed a city or a population, I think we can think about our food supply in a similar way, and the city of San Francisco is actually going to try and model that.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, institutional purchasing is critical. So if the hospitals, schools, the city itself in any given city, there's huge dollars there that if they could be redirected to local organic biodynamic sources would have a tremendous impact. So there are numerous examples in various parts of the country where that's taking off right now. So that'll be a good catalyst for this market.
One example of that is a company that was born locally here called Revolution Foods, mm-hmm. which draws on local food sources and supplies school lunches to public schools in the region. Mm-hmm. They've actually, believe it or not, received venture funding. I say believe it or not because it's not a typical company that you see receive venture funding in this part of the world. But my understanding is that they're doing well and they're mm-hmm. and they're growing, no pun intended. But some of the other things that municipalities and cities can do are promote the specialty crops that are grown in their regions. Obviously, everyone in the Bay Area and to a large extent around the world knows about the wine-growing regions of Napa and Sonoma. We've done a great job of marketing those crops. There are all sorts of things we can do on a more localized level to let our populace know what are some of the healthy and delicious foods that we produce locally and to support the entrepreneurs who are trying to build lifestyle businesses locally and provide those foods to the consumers in their regions.
And how do you all feel about whether food companies should become public and thereby be more, you know, held more responsible to their shareholders, the eaters of the world?
Well, I mean, this again is an hour-long question in and of itself. And what Naomi means is publicly traded corporations. And this is a project that some of us have been working on the last couple of years to try and create a network of local stock exchanges that would allow people to invest in companies that are based, owned and locally owned, locally based, and are primarily producing products and serving the local community. I don't think there should be regulations saying that a company cannot go public on the public markets, the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, what have you. But I think what Michael touched on at the very beginning is critical, is that there is rampant short-termism that's baked into that system where companies have to report profits quarterly. And the CEOs hate it. They would much rather look out 5-10 years or more. But we as investors and the investment analysts on Wall Street are driving these stock prices. And it is a major problem, particularly with food, because with software or other kinds of industries, there's sometimes a natural course for those businesses to grow exponentially in 3 to 5 years. That is not the natural course for a food business. A food business where they're talking about the growing side, the you know, the distribution, processing, value-added brands. Food is a more is a more long-term enterprise, and so the it's a big issue, and that's why I go back to what I said at the beginning: is we would like to help create more opportunities for people like those of you in the room to invest in local privately held companies by making loans or other kinds of ways of getting involved in those businesses, so that we're not perpetuating this financial casino where we're just looking at our statement quarterly for our retirement savings and hoping it's gone from 7.6% to 7.8%. I mean, that's what we're trying to get away from, is more direct, transparent, personal connections with the companies that we're invested in.
Yeah, I'll just add a brief comment to that, which is that farmers have a saying. They say you can't farm fast, and so obviously that's very true from a natural perspective, a biological perspective. But when we look at public markets, typically the reasons for companies to go public is for it's a means of liquidity for their existing investors, and it's a means of raising capital to help that company grow and scale to very large degrees. As Don suggested, and as we've talked about a little bit here this evening, that may not be the only model that's available. And so I would posit that because of the numbers that we discussed a little bit here earlier, only 1.7% of all U.S. farms are corporate farms. I'm venturing to guess the definition of corporate farms, as it's described in this Washington Post series, are public entities. And the vast majority, about 1.9 million farms in the U.S., are small to medium or lifestyle farms. Those farms are operating on other business models. They're not public. We can find ways to funnel capital appropriately to the best companies that are still remaining private.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing the centralization of our food. Joining me this discussion are Paul Frankel, Managing Director, Ecosa Capital, Michael Dimmick, President of Roots of Change, and Don Schaefer, President and CEO of RSF Social Finance. One of our audience members asked, do any of the panelists foresee that the federal government will take action to reduce the level of concentration in the meatpacking industry?
I think it's possible. I think that there's been a growing awareness of the problem. What we're really talking about is that there are basically four companies maybe that produce or control 80% of the meat production in the country. So that has an impact on markets. It squeezes the price of markets. If there are only a small number of buyers, then the ability of a price to rise and fall is impeded. So it's an important issue. A large number of ranchers in the United States are concerned about this problem and have been pounding on the USDA and the Congress for years to no avail. So I think it's possible. We'll see what happens in the next cycle, a new Congress, new president. We'll see what happens. I think it's a good time to bring it up, and I encourage everyone to get on the internet in the next 2 weeks and look for something called fooddeclaration.org. Fooddeclaration.org. You will find a petition and declaration calling for action by our leaders, policymakers, around issues like this particular issue. This issue is brought up in one of the 12 principles that outlines how our food system could become more healthy. What is healthy policy? It gets on this issue of concentration. So I encourage you to look at that and sign on, because we're going to use that hopefully to educate our policymakers.
I think implicit in that question was, obviously, in the news and in this year alone, we had one of the largest beef recall in the history of the United States. 143 million pounds of beef were recalled, and 50 million pounds went to school children alone. So what is the connection between centralization and food safety? Why are we seeing an increase in food safety problems in the United States? Is it related to centralization?
You bet. I mean, it's a relentless profit maximization that these companies, these publicly traded companies, are under. I mean, it's a lot easier to rationalize cutting corners or not treating workers well, et cetera, if your bosses and your boss's bosses are the sole thing they're looking at is how much profit can we squeeze out this quarter. So that's the fundamental force that is creating centralization is the Wall Street markets, and I think that's the case in Southern California. That's pretty much the answer.
And also going back, go ahead. Concentration. The fact that you have to have huge pools of product coming into one factory, and so you have contamination. One small piece of meat that's ground up and then mixed with millions of pounds of other meat creates these huge problems, and it's not just E. coli, it's BSE, it's many other problems.
And conversely, the opposite is true, right? So we see that if we localize food and distribution is limited to regions, if there is a food safety problem, then it will be limited to the region in which that food is distributed. So I would say there's kind of a double positive there for the argument of localism.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question. I would ask each of you to give the audience and those listening to this program on the radio a takeaway, what you as an individual can do with this issue. How do you take away? What can we do with respect to centralization of our food?
I'll go first. I would say that the thing that I try to do and encourage other people to do is to buy from retailers or buy at farmers markets or buy directly from farmers. And if you buy from a retailer, you ask that retailer to stock up on what's local and what's seasonal. I think that's a big plus for the system. So we like to say vote with your fork and vote with your dollar. I think we have huge potential in this country to change markets worldwide by how we purchase. So you all have the power to do it, to make the change. It doesn't matter what the regulations are in the end. If every American decided they were going to spend 50% of their food budget on local food, it would transform the system very quickly.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And we can actually see the transformation of the market. At least I've seen it locally, and I think we've seen it in the middle of the country as well with penetration of natural organic foods into grocery stores and retail outlets there, that the American palate has become somewhat more sophisticated, and there's been a proliferation of choice in supply as well. And so patronizing those businesses that are favorites of consumers, that are excellent producers, that represent the values that you hold near and dear in your community and in your family, is going to result in an economic benefit both to that company and to the community. The other thing I want to say is that centralization in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing, just kind of recapping from earlier, that some aspects of centralization are necessary to thriving, healthy businesses. And we shouldn't vilify centralization, but we should optimize it in order to achieve the outcomes that we want.
Yeah, I'd say a great exercise to do would be to look at, for 1 month, where your money goes for food purchasing, and then at the same time also look at where your money's going in terms of your investments. So we like to say that we look at money at RSF Social Finance the way a biodynamic farmer looks at soil, where if you can shrink the distance between the connection between you and your food and you and what your money's doing, that'll make a tremendous difference. And so whether it's CSAs, now there's community-supported kitchens as well. Organization called Three Stone Hearth in Berkeley is pioneering this. Some of you may have heard about this, where you pick up prepared food. It's using local, organic, nutrient-dense foods here in the Bay Area. So this is an example of where you're shrinking the distance between the source of your food, and you're building relationship with where your food comes from. And so if you just did an analysis of where your money's going in terms of your investments and where it's going in terms of your food purchasing for 1 month, and tried to, you know, take a 5% challenge, you know, over the course of a year, even to go spend 5% more of your food purchasing or 5% more of your investable assets into local and organically produced food or local businesses that are doing what you think are good things, that'd be great.
May I also add, I encourage everyone here to write two letters. I think you should write to the governor of your state and ask them to plant a garden at the state capitol. And then I think you should write a letter to the President of the United States and ask them to plant a garden at the White House as a symbol of the nation's need to reconnect with the production and supply of food, because I think there is an awakening going on. I think it would be symbolic for the leaders of our state and nation to, in fact, plant those gardens.
And if you haven't already had a chance to go to the Slow Food Nation Victory Garden in front of San Francisco City Hall, it's a very powerful civic statement of the future of urban food production. I do have one follow-up question for you, Don, and that is just to give the audience and listeners a sense of what are some of the options they can take with respect to financial tools. If they wanted to go to the Internet and do a quick search, maybe you could just give us a few tips there.
Sure. Well, you could start with rsfsocialfinance.org. The minimum of $1,000 to participate in our loan fund that's going out and making loans to the types of businesses we talked about tonight. Some of these organizations are only open to accredited investors right now. That will change, but a very interesting one is called Upstream 21. That's Upstream and just the numbers 21.com. Leslie Christian started this organization a few years ago, and essentially it's a holding company, a regional holding company that's buying interest in locally owned and controlled businesses in the Northwest. They're going to expand, though, so that when there are succession issues, when the farmers or the timber company owners need to retire, and there's a huge wave of baby boomer entrepreneurs that are going to be retiring in coming years, they don't have to sell out to a publicly traded competitor or shut the business down, because these are anchor businesses in their communities, but rather they can sell a chunk of the business to Upstream 21, get some liquidity, and have an enlightened partner whose values match up with their commitment to sustainability. And so there are a number of others that I could mention as well, but I'll just leave it at that for the moment.
And I'd also like to just share with you, if you don't already know the website, localharvest.org. It's a fantastic website to help you identify local farmers markets in your areas, CSAs, community-supported agriculture farms, where you can buy a subscription to a farm's produce for a week, a season. It's a great way to invest in local farmers directly to the source. And I just wanted to ask you, Paul and Michael, in terms of the future for food production, if there was one thing besides obviously what we've talked about here that you think would make a difference in our public policy, what would it be?
I think that we need to completely transform the subsidy system in this country to actually promote two big things, stewardship and health. I think that the current system, as we've talked about, is about cheap calories. I think we can do this. I think there are a lot of people in the country that are interested in doing it, both on the health side, the farming side, the environmental side. So I think we could actually, in the next 3 years, have a tremendous debate in this country and transform the subsidy system.
I think the best way to kind of grasp this issue is to go out to a fantastic meal, or better yet, make a fantastic meal at home with family and friends, and make that meal from local sources. Obviously, some of the programs that Slow Food is hosting are kind of based on this notion of food and community, and to live that and then to express that to friends and people in your sphere of influence, I think, would go very far to, again, have an opinion about things like the farm bill and like food subsidies, like the food versus fuel issue, like the impending food crisis and so forth. And we can educate ourselves simply by making the right choices.
Thank you so much to our panelists, Don Schaefer, President and CEO of RSF Social Finance, Michael Dimmick, President of Roots of Change, and Paul Frankel, Managing Director of Ecosa Capital. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. This program is part of our How We Eat series, a month-long series of programs that take an in-depth look at our eating habits, health, and the mechanisms surrounding how we get our food. I'm Naomi Starkman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.